I'm Jean Marie Laskus. I'm a journalist. I spent my career helping Americans understand the lives of other Americans. Coal miners, gun shop clerks, staffers in the White House mailroom. In my new podcast, Cement City, I tell the story of an entire town. A dying town that you have absolutely no reason to care about. But trust me, you will. Listen to and follow Cement City, an Odyssey original podcast in partnership with Cement City Productions. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
From Odyssey, I'm Lauren Berry, and this is the On Deadline podcast, where you get a deeper look at stories from our radio newsrooms across the nation. Today On Deadline is looking back at the controversial NFL star who started his career with jaw-dropping moves on the football field and later became famous for something else entirely. He was America's most notorious criminal defendant, unconvicted, but guilty in the eyes of many. O.J. Simpson. Last week, Simpson's family shared that he had passed away after losing his battle with prostate cancer. By the time he died, Simpson had changed the way we look at criminal cases, race, inequities in the justice system, celebrity, and so much more. After his death was announced, many began reminiscing on Simpson's complicated life and the court case at the center of it, which had the nation in a thrall. The trial of the century was what many called it. Now, let's rewind the tape. On June 12, 1994, Nicole Brown Simpson, the ex-wife of O.J. Simpson, was murdered outside her home in Brentwood, California. It was just a month after the pair had officially split. Brown Simpson was stabbed to death at her home, along with her friend Ron Goldman. In the days after their deaths, police began investigating, narrowing the list of possible suspects to one. But when it was announced that police were seeking O.J. Simpson as a suspect in the case, the former Buffalo Bills running back was nowhere to be found. Now let's fast forward to June 17, 1994. During Game 5 of the NBA Finals, the cameras suddenly switched to a helicopter shot from over Los Angeles. In what would end up becoming the most infamous low-speed police chase in history, an estimated 95 million people watched as Al Cowlings drove O.J. inside a white Ford Bronco, fleeing from police. To share more on the chase that started the downfall of O.J. Simpson, Zoe Ter, the pilot who filmed the chase from the helicopter, joined Odyssey.
Of course, you have a pretty prominent role in the O.J. Simpson story. Take us back to June 17th, 1994. Police had been searching for O.J. Simpson, and you, in your helicopter, found the pursuit. Tell us how that happened.
Well, I was downtown at Parker Center waiting for O.J. Simpson to turn himself in, but he never showed up. Lieutenant Gascon from the LAPD announced to us that O.J. Simpson was in the wind. And I was taken aback. I mean, really? He's a fugitive? So I got into the helicopter with my crew and said, look, we got to find him. So, you know, we live in a city with millions and millions of people, thousands and thousands of miles of roadway. How are you going to find him? Every lawman in the country, every reporter, you know, citizens, everybody's looking for O.J. So I decided to fly down to the gravesite of Nicole Simpson Brown. I thought he would go down there. And I believed him to be a narcissist. And I thought he would go down there and try to solicit sympathy. When I got down there, it took about 20 minutes to get down there. And while I was flying over the cemetery, I saw nobody down there but an undercover police unit staking the cemetery out. So thinking he might be in the area, I started making larger turns with my helicopter. And then we got the word that O.J. Simpson had been seen in the area of the El Toro Y. Our news director, Mary Helen Campos, told me that. So I started listening to the FBI frequencies. They had triangulated him to the area of the El Toro Y, which is the 405 and 5 freeways. I looked down through the chin bubble of the helicopter, and I saw a white Bronco right below me. And within a moment, I saw a sheriff's vehicle pull up, and then another one, and another one, and the highway patrol, and the vehicle didn't stop. So at that point, I knew that we had O.J. I descended, got a closer look, and indeed, it was O.J. Simpson, and the rest is history.
It is some amazing work. And you were alone up there following the chase for, what, a good 20 minutes or so?
Yeah, we were the only reporters covering the story at CBS and KNX Radio for over 20 minutes. The next helicopter arrived was a KNBC helicopter. And it was a huge news scoop, obviously. I mean, we're in the news business. And I was kind of in a state of shock because this was a celebrity. This was the perfect intersection of celebrity and crime, and it was O.J. Simpson, and he was running from the police like a common criminal. It was shocking, surreal. And then to see, you know, people that had heard it listening on CBS radio or watching on television started, you know, they left their homes and they went to the freeway to capture a glimpse of history to see O.J. Simpson's, you know, last run as he was being chased by police. So it was a huge scoop from a news standpoint, but it was also something that was it was very troubling to me because of the seriousness of the crimes, the victims. You know, O.J. Simpson died surrounded by, you know, family, grandchildren in his own bed at age 76. Ron Goldman and Nicole Simpson Brown were in the prime of their lives, and they died in a pool of blood alone. And that still strikes me today.
This is Jean Marie Laskus with the podcast Cement City. So there's this election coming up, a big one, and one guy's been indicted. People are talking voter fraud. Democracy itself is on the line. Sound familiar? Well, this isn't that election. This one is in Denora, Pennsylvania, a dying town in the middle of nowhere, where I bought a house and stayed for 3 years. Listen to and follow Cement City, an Odyssey original podcast in partnership with Cement City Productions, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
At the conclusion of the chase, Simpson was arrested and charged with the murders of Brown, Simpson, and Goldman, setting the stage for a trial that riveted America. Many watched the twists and turns, testimony and rebuttals by OJ's so-called dream team of pricey lawyers. "If it doesn't fit, you must acquit," became a national punchline. Prosecutor Marsha Clark's hair and her personal life became a tabloid obsession. People tuned in like it was any other daytime TV show, except in this one, the stakes were real. Strangely enough, years later, the family of OJ's friend and defense attorney Robert Kardashian would actually become some of the most well-known reality TV stars in the world. Kris Jenner, a member of that family, was Nicole Brown Simpson's best friend. But going back to the trial, it was about more than just drama. It carried the underpinnings of racial injustice as it happened in Los Angeles just after the Rodney King case and riots. There was also a class warfare element, as rich and famous OJ had allegedly already beaten his wife bloody numerous times and walked away without jail time. He ended up paying what could have been the priciest team of lawyers in history an estimated $50,000 a day during the trial, and he was eventually acquitted. This case still impacts how we cover trials today. To share more, Jane Kirtley from the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication joined Odyssey.
I mean, am I absolutely correct in saying that the O.J. Simpson trial absolutely transformed the way we cover news and consume news in the U.S., if not the world?
Yes. I think for me, there are two threads for this. One is that this case was the birth of the 24/7 cable coverage of a high-profile trial, supplemented with pundits, typically lawyers or law professors, who had nothing to do with the trial themselves, but acted as the Monday morning quarterbacks to talk about and interpret what was transpiring in the courtroom. And I have very mixed feelings about that. We can explore that.
As do I. Yes.
But I think that's the first thing. And then the second thing is that because of what happened in the O.J. trial. And because of the perceptions by members of the judiciary and the public and the bar as well, it dealt a setback to the attempt to get television cameras in federal courts and in many states as well. Because in my opinion, quite incorrectly, the presence of cameras was blamed for many, many things that were problematic in that trial. I don't think that's true. I don't agree with it. But the legacy is still coming back to haunt us today here in Minnesota as recently as during the Chauvin trial. People were still talking about the O.J. Simpson case.
I find it surprising, Jane, I guess that you, so you believe that the cameras in the O.J. Simpson courtroom did not play a role in I guess, what are you saying? That, because I think a lot of people thought that, you know, attorneys were playing up to the camera. They thought the judge in that case, Judge Ito, was playing to the cameras and that somehow influenced the case. But you disagree with that?
I do, and I will tell you why. Cameras in California courts was not a new thing with the O.J. Simpson case. It was just one of the examples of a really high-profile trial that triggered national attention. Judge Ito was the presiding judge. He was the captain of the ship. He literally controlled the cameras in the courtroom, and he also was the one who had to control the trial participants, including the lawyers. At that time, California had very, very liberal rules about statements that lawyers could make outside of the courtroom about the trial. They have since tightened them up quite a bit. But at that time, they could do courthouse steps interviews and say anything they wanted, which was unlike the rules in virtually every other state in the country. So it's my contention that Judge Ito really did not live up to his responsibilities to control what the lawyers were doing in the courtroom, and equally important, what they were doing outside of the courtroom. He had authority to do that. He chose not to exercise it. So to blame it on the camera, I think, is really unfair. It was the things that Judge Ito failed to do that led to all these problems.
O.J.'s acquittal in the murder of his wife and her friend wasn't the end of his story. A civil trial also took place, and in it, Simpson was found liable for the murders of Brown Simpson and Goldman. The families of the victims were awarded $33.5 million in damages. O.J. was still responsible for paying that debt up to the time of his death. Attorney David Cook, who represents the Goldman family, joined Odyssey after O.J.'s death to discuss the payments.
How does his death, O.J.'s death, impact the ability to collect from the Simpson estate?
Well, that's a different matter. That's a different matter because obviously he's dead and we have to start this out to figure out what it is, where it is. We've had over the years that he has these pensions, I believe, saying these are ours. Now he's died. What goes thereafter is another matter. So there may be a trustee around here. For all I know, there may be a probate floating around here, which I don't know. But there obviously will be a lot of steps to be taking after he's died here.
David, how has he been able to evade payments for so long?
Well, if he's had a pension here and or other things which have protected him either by under California law and or U.S. law, then some of it may protect it. And these issues have been raised here literally 20 years ago or more when the lawyers representing Goldman have attempted to look at that. And of course, then O.J. Simpson was able to avoid some of this money there or all of this money on his pension. Here.
Do we know how much money is still owed to the Goldman family?
Well, that's a different matter here. I couldn't even begin to that one. I do know, of course, that we had if I did it, and then ultimately we obtained the book, and it became to I did it that we acquired, and that became the United States, that became, pardon me, the New York Times bestseller, and we hit number two on that.
O.J. Simpson's case highlighted America's racial divide, with many more black than white Americans cheering the verdict when it happened. For his part, O.J. wanted no part in the racial discussion. He allegedly told a sociologist at one point that he didn't want to be seen as black, just as O.J. He eventually retired after serving time for the armed robbery of two collectibles dealers in a Las Vegas hotel room and spent his latter years golfing with pals. He made headlines with a tell-all book titled If I Did It, using knife emojis on social media and issuing speculation on other celebrity murder allegations. He had previously vowed to spend the rest of his life looking for the real killer, but seemed to put that in his rearview mirror. OJ's gleeful freedom underscored for many pundits the rise of a new culture, a place where celebrities can be convicted or caught in a scandal, then write books, pose for photos, rebrand, and reemerge in a shame-free America. This show is produced by Joe Heady, Christy Strouser, and Myron Kaplan. And by me. I'm Lauren Berry, and I want to say thanks for listening to On Deadline. Odyssey serving of a top news story just for you. Subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts to stay informed.
This is Jean Marie Laskus with the podcast Cement City. So there's this election coming up, a big one, and one guy's been indicted. People are talking voter fraud. Democracy itself is on the line. Sound familiar? Well, this isn't that election. This one is in Denora, Pennsylvania, a dying town in the middle of nowhere, where I bought a house and stayed for 3 years. Listen to and follow Cement City, an Odyssey original podcast in partnership with Cement City Productions, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.